Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We're ready to do a briefing on the Protection from Harassment Bill. If I can just introduce my colleagues, it's Mr. Sorrel Robertson, who's going to do the presentation, and Mr. Lynn Clark. Mr. Lynn Clark is from the Law Commission. She's here because she was a researcher throughout when the Law Commission investigated this whole topic and recommended a bill. She was the head of the research unit at the Law Commission, so she's been with this process right from the very, very beginning. We in the department only took over the process once the Law Commission had made recommendations. Chair, we submitted quite a number of documents to the committee. I can just take you through it. With the report of the Law Commission, because the bill is introduced. Then there's a briefing document. The briefing document is going to be dealt with today by Mr. Robertson. We also, because we're amending the Domestic Violence Act, or we refer to the Domestic Violence Act quite a lot, we've given a copy of the Domestic Violence Act, and because we're amending the Firearms Control Act, we've also given you a copy of those provisions so that you can see them in context. We've given a summary of all the comments that were made at the Portfolio Committee and the Department's responses to those comments. And then the bill as it was approved by the Portfolio Committee. Chair, we would like your guidance. The briefing document is quite comprehensive. I should imagine it'll take us about half an hour to go through it. I don't know whether you want Mr. Robertson to give a shortened version of it, or should he take you through all the detail that's contained in the briefing document. Thank you.
I can give you a shortened version.
My first originated from investigation by the African Law Reform Commission, which is talking about there, and then the bill was recommended by them, which is actually based on the Domestic Violence Act, which makes provision for a civil remedy against stalking. The bill was introduced in the Portfolio Committee, Justice and Constitutional Development, and they made certain amendments to the bill as introduced. The main amendment that was made to the bill relates to the tracking of the alleged harasser and part of specific defenses that is available to the press. This is the fact that the bill, according to their perception, can be used against the press an extent prohibit reporters to report on certain things that is important for the community as a whole. So, I believe some of the members actually saw certain movies like Italia, Cape Fear, or Sleeping with the Enemy, or One Hour Fighter, you know what Stalking entails. That's a practical example of what Stalking entails. Can be gathered from the following examples. In Italia, where a father and master posted explicit photos of a person on a certain website with contact numbers and the message in Italia that the tendency of this person is to be gang raped. That may amount to stalking. Further examples, maybe where a psychotic criminal after convicted for assault after his prison term expired to actually keep on contacting his victim and make further remarks regarding the incident to her. That will amount to something like harassment for purposes of the bill. Further also another example maybe where a person is posted on a prison website. And the reason for posting him there is to let him look like a criminal, or that he has got certain tendencies, like he is maybe a psychopath, a child molester or something to that effect, while he is not, that will amount to the harassment. Okay, the harassment from victims has been studied in depth. I'm not going to go into that. But it affects the mental health of the person, the physical health, as well as the general behavior of the victim. In general, the person will become depressed, he'll panic, and there's lots of effects that flow from the harassment. Some South African examples, which was in the media, which concern harassment in Tanzania. The ETV third degree journalist that was harassed and later murdered. Apparently she was stalked. And also the current case in the Western Cape, I think it's High Court now, of Mr. Kumar Singh, who has tried to set the light to the property, of the Rims family as a result of harassment incident that was actually obtained in the United Kingdom. Also referred to Andrea Fenter, a young woman that was murdered after she was stalked for a long period of time by a boyfriend. The remedy that is envisaged in the act is civil in nature, and it's also to an extent very uncomplicated. You don't need something like legal representation to apply for a remedy. An ordinary person can do that and will make provision by the clerk of the court or assist the person to apply for a remedy or stalking harassment incident against the harasser. Just going to take you through the content of the law, the specific clauses. I believe the first clause, what is important there is the definition of harassment, and that is very broadly defined in the bill. Harassment is defined that if a person commits an act of harassment, if he or she directly engages in conduct which he or she knows or ought to know causes harm or inspires reason to believe that harm may be caused to the complainant or related person by unreasonable following, watching, pursuing the complaint or a related person, or engaging in verbal, electronic, or any other communication aimed at the complainant or a related person by any means, whether or not a conversation ensues, or the sending, delivery, or forcing of the delivery of letters, telegrams, faxes, faxing mails, electronic mail, or other objects to the complainant or a related person. Sexual harassment was also included in the definition by the portfolio committee. Something that needs to be pointed out is the term unreasonable in the definition is very important. If you suspect that harassment may consist of various legitimate actions, which may be, if it's viewed on itself, cannot be regarded as something like a crime of a delict. So it's actually left in the hands of the court to decide whether certain actions are deemed to be unreasonable and therefore when it will amount to something like harassment. Again, harassment, parties that's involved is usually a respondent or the harasser and a complainant, but the respondent can also stalk a complainant. If he or she actually stalked somebody else to actually sway the complainant to perceive that action as something that can harm that other person, that will also amount to harassment. So they will actually make the provision for that instance, and if a respondent harass a related person, you will also commit the act of harassment. That is as far as the definition is concerned. Clause 2 actually make provision for the application for a protection order. The procedure that needs to be followed can be done through the clerk, must be done at the magistrate's court. The person that can apply for it is the complainant, the person on behalf of the complainant, and even a child. If there is application on behalf of the complainant, the person that actually make the application, they have written consent of the complainant. The clerk of the court must also, when there's an application and the complainant is not legally presented, there's obligation on him to support the person, the applicant, in the making of the application. And the clerk of the court has also got obligations to inform the complainant that she must lay a criminal charge. And the provision is made that the application for protection order can be made after ordinary court hours in certain circumstances. That's usually where there's imminent harm made as well to the complainant. After application has been made to talk to the court, it must be submitted to a magistrate who must consider the matter. The magistrate will look at the matter and will decide into either if it's an urgent application, and if you will explain the application after hours. The magistrate will list all the evidence that is submitted to him to see if there is harassment. And if the magistrate finds on the evidence available that the defendant is engaging in harassment and that the applicant will suffer harm, he will then grant something like an interim protection order. But interim protection order is interim in nature, that it is only valid for a certain period of time until the matter will be heard by the court to determine if there was real harassment. So it's something called in legal terminology as interim relief. This interim protection order that's granted by the court will be served on the respondent, that is the arrested, and that document or interim order that's served on the respondent will ask the respondent to come to the court on a certain day and show reason to the court why a final protection order cannot be granted against him. An interim protection order will be valid from the time that it came to or come to the attention of the respondent that the court has issued interim protection order against him. It's not necessary to be served on him, so he does have to have notice that the interim protection order was granted against him. Okay, after during that stage, the complainant actually made the complaint, will receive certain documentation, something like a warrant of arrest, which is usually suspended. Suspension means that it's not effective unless a certain condition or prohibition of protection order is contravened. Then only then can the warrant of arrest become active and be activated by the complainant. I will deal with that later on. In order to determine the identity of stalkers is a big problem, especially where cyber harassment takes place. The school makes provision for the tracing of cyber harassers. It's extensive, I'm not going to go through it. I just mentioned this, that this was submitted to the relevant electronic communication service providers. They don't have a problem with that. They see it as a workable process. I may just point out that there's also a provision in that clause that provides that before electronic communication service provider provides the information of the cyber stalker to a court, that that information, before it's provided to court, before service provider providing information to the court, that the service provider must inform the person whose information is going to be handed over to the court of the fact that this information is supplied to the court. basically, electronic communication service provider has got the capability to determine from where and from which person certain communication originated. That information is usually supplied to the court. The court will consider that. And if a prima facie case has been made out during the application that harassment has taken place and the court gets this information, the court can then grant interim protection order against the cyber harasser. Clause 4 is a similar provision to Clause 5. Clause 5 is a similar provision to Clause 4. In terms of Clause 5, the court may order the South African police to investigate certain instances of harassment, again, where the identity considered particulars of the harasser is not known. If the police of the investigation are able to identify the particulars of the harasser, it must be furnished to the court, and the court can then, again, grant an interim protection order if a prima facie case has been made out to be more in fact harassment. So six, similar nature to Clause 5, Clause 6 provides for instances where prerogative discretion to the South African Police Services to investigate instances of harassment where a complaint is directly made to the South African Police Service, and it can then investigate the matter. Clause 6 also contain certain guidelines on how the South African police must act in terms of Clause 5, and this will be further regulated by directives that will be issued by the National Commission of the South African Police. Clause 7 creates a mechanism for the court to subpoena witnesses during proceedings. So if there's application for harassment, the court may proceed, or rather subpoena witnesses, give oral evidence, also to submit books, documents, or any other thing to the court. If you're subpoenaed by the court and you don't comply with the subpoena, you can make an appearance. Clause 8 make provision that proceedings may in certain circumstances be held behind closed doors. It might be on application of a party of its own accord. If the court decides it's in the interest of the administration of justice. But before the court declare the proceedings closed, and it gives the party present at the proceedings a chance to be heard. If they want to publish certain information, make a formal application to the court and ask the court if they can publish this information. Clause 9 deals with the final protection order. I pointed out that the initial protection order is the interim protection order. Then the court will determine a hearing date. Clause 9 provides for the hearing date. Two scenarios is provided for in Clause 9. Firstly, if the respondent does not attend court proceedings, and the court may then obviously grant a permanent protection order against the respondent. If the respondent attends court proceedings and wants to oppose the proceedings, the court must hear the matter, and then after the hearing, of course, most likely in court proceedings, find which case is more probable, and the court finds that harassment has taken place, the court can then grant a permanent protection order. Clause 9 is also important in that it makes provision for a specific defense, which must, or not a defense, but circumstances that must be considered. If the court takes the circumstances into account to determine whether the conduct is unreasonable and therefore amounts to harassment, these factors, it's on the idea, whether the conduct it was engaged upon was for the purpose of protecting or preventing an offence. Also, further to review a threat to public safety or environment. Also, to review that an undue advantage is being or was given to a person in a competitive bidding process or to comply with a legal duty. So, this is factors that must be taken into account if the court wants to determine whether a conduct is unreasonable or unlawful and harassment. The court may make certain orders to provide further protection to the complainant in this case when the proceedings have started in the area. That certain questions that is asked in court where the arrest is not represented by a legal representative, the bill provides that in that instance the arrestor must pose these questions to the court, and the court must then pose it to the complainant. This is just to ensure that the complainant is not further traumatized by directly facing the arrestor. Clause 10 contains the powers of the court in respect of the protection order. I think notable is that the court may prohibit harassment of the complainant by whatever means. I'm not going to deal further with that. And then clause 11, already referred to, where the interim protection order has been granted, that a warrant of arrest will be issue for the respondent, and that warrant of arrest for recruitment preparation, usually when there is a non-compliance with the condition of the protection order. Clause 11 provides for the protection order, it's quite precisely what it is. The protection order will usually be issued by the court. After the act is issued by the court, it will be served on the complainant who will be in possession of the warrant. If there is non-compliance with the condition of protection order, the complainant must make a statement, affidavit, to the effect that the respondent contravened the protection order. This must then be handed over to a police official. The police official must then, in terms of this law, either arrest the arrestor for not complying with the protection order, but under certain circumstances, when there is not imminent danger to the complainant, the police official might also issue a written notice in terms of which the arrestor will then have to appear in court on a certain environment date. The staff makes provision that the court may order members of South African police to seize a weapon in possession of or under control of the arrestor, and that a copy of evidence that's presented during this trial has then been submitted to the National Commission of the South African Police and to earlier to further provided to determine if the person against whom such order has been granted is still a fit person to possess a firearm. So certain make provision for the evaluation and putting in fight for order. Parties may have made it to the court to fight for a variation, setting aside the protection order. The court can grant this. If the court is sure that this is done fully and voluntary by the complainant, of course, 14 deals with jurisdiction. In general, the court has wide jurisdiction to grant the protection order. What's further important, which is very important. important in the Bill of Law system, which in the AIA provides for the service of prisoners and states. In Clause 15 states how service of the state must take place in terms of the bill. Another very important provision in the bill is Clause 16, which deals with cost orders. In general, the open sector will be free, but Clause 16 gives the court the discretion to grant a cost order against the party if the application is frivolous or without any base. Then the court can grant a cost order against such person. In general, the proceedings in terms of the fact will be subject to appeal and review. If they can criminalize certain conduct, most notably if a person contravenes a protection order. Also, if a person makes a false statement that protection order was contravened by a person, that is also criminalized. There's various obligations that's placed on the electronic communication service provider that is also criminalized, most notably if they don't comply with the time period within which they can give certain information to the court. And also, if the health police investigation in case of harassment, if a person or a policeman investigate an instance of harassment in terms of the court order, in terms of clause 5 of the bill, and they request the person to give his name and surname and fill a particular to the police official, and the person does not do that, the person actually commits a punishable offence. Furthermore, to give practical effect to the Act, regulations need to be made in terms of the Act, and that's regulated by Clause 20, and Clause 20 and 21 affect the consequential amendment to the Firearms Control Act. Again, further to regulate the fitness of the person to be listed in the firearms. Thank you.
Honourable members, do you want to engage with the Honourable Gandhi, Honourable Group?
Yes. Chairperson, I reserve the right to ask something that has been said if I, because I'm not privy to the access of the document myself. I was just relying on my listening skills. One is to get clarity in with regards to the level of the court. I know he mentioned clause 14 as a jurisdiction something. I'm not too sure. Jurisdiction as an area strictly, or as well as in terms of the, is this a magistrate court, so to speak? That's the question. That's the clarity I want to check, whether to access to which courts we're referring to. Is this a magistrate court? Possibilities of appeal. Are there possibilities of that, or is that's dependent on the magistrate or the judicial the officer? Then, secondly, if you could emphasize, if you did mention the issues of practically, how does this thing work? You have to go and lay a complaint with the police, the first point of access. Is to lay a complaint with the police, or I'm not sure they're still in place, these things, Chair, like there used to be peace orders where you go to to court and just get a peace order, and what does this act then propose to do with such things if they still exist? That would also that would also relate to J88 or something, which also handled some of the related matters in relation to harassment and all that. Thirdly, Chair, I'm not sure whether the list is exhaustive of the acts that would somehow be affected consequentially and otherwise. But my specific question would be to check if this harassment is prescribed here does also take cognizance of what was what is contained in the Children's Act in relation to the bullying and harassment and that kind of. Of a thing. Just a general question then, Chair, also, is in terms of a definition of this harassment, I also haven't read it, and the question of noise and nuisance, you know, generally those are the cases. But the big one, Chair, would be what kind of implementation arrangements that this act is setting out in relation to the cluster, the justice cluster, Chair, because the harassment, it's almost like your daily contact with people, so it's going to have a huge impact in terms of people's relations. And it might require a lot of human capacity in terms of the criminal justice itself, including your courts, the administration of this area. Might so. What are the arrangements in as far as that is concerned? Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I will say that I went through this document now. And I don't see any problem personally. You see on page 17 there was a thorough consultation with different structures of society to look into this whole bill. So I. You know our position in this committee, that we are all the time unfortunate to get things at the tail end of the story. But I will propose that let us adopt this bill. You see? He have proposed the other time. Now in an adoption. I have read through this thing. Comrade Louis, he's harassing me. Please, yeah, I'm adopting it because that's harassment. I'm going to charge you, Chairperson. I will propose that let us adopt this.
But can you respond to the questions raised by Honourable Zuman?
Sorry, Chair.
Just a moment, Honourable.
I support Honourable Zuman's proposal.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'll ask my colleagues to respond. A point that I want to make is that this bill, the provisions of this bill, are very, very similar. I think that's why you may be familiar with them, because really they are so similar to the provisions in the Domestic Violence Act. It's interim orders, protection orders, final protection orders. But here we're dealing with stalking outside the domestic relationship. As I say, I'm going to ask my colleagues to deal with it just on the implementation and training, and that comes back to, I think there is going to be a little bit of training that is necessary, but because of this law being so similar to the Domestic Violence Act, I think the training is not going to, we've already had the basis there. A lot of trading has been done on the domestic violence, perhaps not enough. But I think from an implementation point of view in the justice cluster, we've been assured by our department in the justice cluster, that's most notably, that they are geared and they are ready to deal with this when it becomes law. Not to the detail of this law, like in, I think, in the Domestic Violence Act, the detail, how the process is served by the courts, how the protection orders are served on the respondents, all that detail is going to be dealt with in the regulations that are going to come. So I just wanted to make that point. Thank you. I'm going to hand over to my colleague.
This question relates to the level of court. The process here is usually instituted in a magistrate's court. So if it's a magistrate's court, that will hear harassment applications. If you talk about jurisdiction, that usually relates to the kind of conduct which magistrate's court will have the necessary jurisdiction. We made provisions for that in clause 14 of the bill, and it stipulates any court within the area in which the complainant permanently or temporarily resides, carries on business, or is employed. The respondent permanently or temporarily resides, carries on business, or is employed, or the course of action arrives, has jurisdiction to issue a protection order as provided for in this Act. Okay, practically, next question was how practically will this work? I explained at the beginning that application for a protection order is usually made at a clerk of the court, at a magistrate's court. The clerk of the court will receive the application. He will submit it to a magistrate. The magistrate will then consider this application and see if
there's any evidence that relates to harassment. Often a magistrate has considered this. The magistrate may grant interim protection order or may not. If the magistrate does not grant interim protection order, it's usually remanded to a further date. And even if the magistrate grant interim protection order, it is interim in nature, and the return date will usually be determined by the court in which a final or application will take place, a formal hearing rather, not application, where all the parties will come together and then present the evidence to the court. After the magistrate has heard all the evidence, he or she can then issue a final protection order.
Chair, can I just add on to that, because I heard the Honourable Member talk about, do you have to go to a police station? Your first port of call, as Mr. Roberts has said, is really go to the court and you'll work through the clerk of the court. That's if you know who the harasser is. You might get a situation where you don't know who the harasser is, particularly when it's done, when it's cyber stalking, and that's why that procedure has been built in, where you would, the complainant would still go to the court. Say, this is the harassment that's taking place, but it's come through electronically, and I don't know who the culprit is. And that's when the court, if it's come through on electronic communications, that's where the court has the power to then request the electronic service providers, your cell phone companies and your internet companies, to go and do a search on their systems and see who submitted that or who sent those messages through the cyberspace to try and get the identity of the stalker, and that's when the electronic service provider must give that information through to the court so that you have a person, you know who the person is, or you know properly who the person is that's doing the stalking, and then you take the process forward. But the bill does also give another option where you don't have to go directly to the magistrate's court. And I'm just looking at my colleagues for clause 6. There is another option where you can go to the police, and that's dealt with in clause 6.2. And the police will then also help you try and get the identity of the stalker. So there is a port of call at the police station, but your first port of call generally is at, you go directly to the port.
The relevance of peace orders, Section 384 of the Criminal Procedure Act of 1955, is still in place. That can also be used as a remedy. I believe the department is currently looking at possible amendment.
Section 384 of the Criminal Procedure Act of 1955 to make it more effective. So it is an alternative remedy that is also available, but due to the fact that it is outdated, cannot provide provide similar protection that is then as is provided for in the Act, or the bill rather, rather than the law.
The question regarding the Day 88 and harassment relates to the Day 88 comes into play with you, actually for the sexual offence, and the Day 88 is filled in with the details of the sexual offence on it. So once a person has been subjected to a sexual offence, often the person that is a culmination of a stalking event, and the stalking doesn't necessarily end thereafter. And this is where a harassment order, a civil order, would be necessary for a person who is a victim of a sexual offence to prevent further interaction with this person. So it would be relevant in that context, and that's not available to a sexual offence victim at this point in time. And then the question was raised, does the bill take cognizance of the Children's Act and bullying? The Children's Act deals with care and protection of children, and it doesn't provide any civil remedy for children with regard to harassment. So what this would provide is to provide a remedy for children, especially in social networking, when they're on their Mixits and on their Facebooks and BBMs, and where you do have a lot of cyberbullying going on, and the Facebooks and that, so they would be able to make use of this remedy to prevent the bullying before it goes further and you end up with children committing suicide and a number of the other unfortunate incidents that have already happened.
Okay, regarding the question, what about noise and nuisance? I've pointed out that one of the prerequisites for harassment is that the conduct complained of must be unreasonable. It depends on the amount of noise and nuisance that is created. So I believe if it's unreasonable, it may amount to harassment. That is something that's left to the court to decide. The definition of harassment is very wide. It does not per se, or let me rather say, it's so wide that almost any conduct that can take place can be brought under the definition of harassment. I can maybe just read out the whole definition for you that's contained in clause 1 of the bill, which says, harassment means directly or indirectly engaging in conduct that a respondent knows or ought to know causes harm or inspires a reasonable belief that harm may be caused to the complainant or a related person by unreasonably, firstly, following, watching, pursuing, or accosting of the complainant or related person, or loitering outside or near the building or place where the complainant or a related person resides, works, carries on business, studies, or happens to be. Furthermore, engage in verbal, electronic, or any other communications aimed at a complainant or a related person by any means, whether or not a conversation ensues, or, furthermore, sending, delivering or causing the delivery of letters, telegrams, packages, facsimiles, electronic mail or any other object to the complainant or related person, or leaving them where they will be found by, given to or brought to the attention of the complainant or a related person, and also sexual harassment.
will be deemed to be harassment. Sexual harassment is however defined. And sexual harassment is defined as any, firstly, unwelcome sexual attention from a person who knows or ought reasonably to know that such attention is unwelcome. Furthermore, unwelcome explicit or implicit behavior, suggestions, messages, or remarks of a sexual nature that have the effect of offending, intimidating, or humiliating the complainant or a related person in circumstances which a reasonable person, having regard to all the circumstances, would have anticipated that a complainant or a related person would be offended, humiliated, or intimidated. Furthermore, implied or expressed promise of reward complying with a sexual orientated request, or further, an implied or expressed threat of reprisal or actual reprisal for refusal to comply with a sexual oriented request. As such, the definition is very wide, but the cornerstone of judging whether the conduct amounts to harassment will be the reasonableness of the act complained of.
Thank you. It's also going back to the question about noise and nuisance. Although you might find situations that noise and nuisance could amount to harassment, as Mr. Roberts says, unreasonable is what you'll judge it by. But I think if you have a look at the definition, and I'm talking now about noise and nuisance, harassment must engage in conduct that the respondent knows or ought to know causes harm or inspires the reasonable belief that harm may be caused. So I think it's coupled to unreasonableness is coupled to harm or a belief that harm might be inflicted. So noise might not necessarily, or nuisance value might not necessarily be amount to harassment, but I should imagine there could be instances where the noise or the nuisance will inspire that belief that harm may be caused. And then harm means there's also a definition of harm, and it means any mental, psychological, physical, or economic harm. So I thought I'd just add that to what Mr. Roberts says.
Regarding the implementation of the Act, Mr. Bassett already pointed out to the committee that the bill is very similar to the Domestic Violence Act. And there's already structures in place that make provision for the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act. Firstly, I think we can actually build on the current structures that is in place. It is foreseen that certain additional training is necessary to clerks of the court, but due to the similarity of the two acts, I don't think there's going to be a real substantial new invention is needed. Somewhere where magistrates, however, probably need some training relates to clause 4 of the bill, which relates to electronic communications that is used for stalking. But I believe Justice College, I talked to them, and Dr. Van der Merwe actually assured me that sufficient training will be provided to magistrates regarding the implementation of the bill, as well as that specific clause. Anything else?
Any further engagement?
No.
No.
Not sure. I just wanted to indicate that I wanted to second the proposal that we adopted.
It has already been
seconded.
Honorable members, thank you very much. The committee has been considered the subject on the protection from harassment bill. I refer to it because that it has agreed to the bill. Thank you very much. Thank you.
They are coming
for
you for now.
Louis,
they must come.
Louis, no, it's okay. I will take my revenge.
Not now.
Should I continue with the presentation?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. With the delegation colleagues with me to my right is Ms. Mabel Ranta, who is the head of the branch socioeconomic support services in the Department of Military Veterans. To my immediate left is Ms. Makaleng Mwatudi, who is the director in the office of the DG. And then across to the left, but depending which side you're looking. But that side, that's Mr. Njigela, who is the Director of Legal Services in the sister Department of Defense. And then next to him is the Advocate Mwabelo, Koroshu Mwabelo, who is the also the second in command, also in the Legal Services branch. That constitutes the team from the Department of Defense. Chairperson, honorable members, thanks for the opportunity to present to you on this Military Veterans Bill, B1 2011. This bill has been through the Portfolio Committee on Defense up to the time that the Portfolio Committee on Defense adopted it. Let me say Portfolio Committee on Defense and Military Veterans. Up to the time that it was adopted in the middle of August of 2011, Chair, honorable members, we had hoped that we would have an earlier opportunity to appear before yourselves, but understood that you had other engagements up to now. And that was based on the fact that we would have wished that by the time the year ends and you go into recess, that we will have hopefully concluded on it. Chairperson, honorable members, the aim of the bill, of our presentation, is to introduce the bill to yourselves, also to highlight or indicate concerns that were raised by members of the public during the public hearings, and then also provide answers to those concerns that were raised by members of the public. Just by way of background, the bill finds its origins in the Military Veterans Task Team. Now, the Military Veterans Task Team was established after the elections in 2009. It will be recalled that the president reconfigured government and ministries, and with respect to military veterans, reconfigured the Ministry of Defense to be Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans. And it was within that context that the newly appointed minister then set up and established a ministerial task team on military veterans. And the mandate of the ministerial task team was to develop policy recommendations that would serve as a framework for management of military veterans affairs in South Africa. Secondly, to recommend policy on benefits or support to military veterans and the institutional structures required to deliver on the envisaged policy, and thirdly, to advise on the appropriateness or otherwise of the current legislation after an evaluation of the current situation or the status quo as it pertains to military veterans is concerned. The Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans was appointed as the chair of the Ministerial Task Team on Military Veterans. Having said for a period of just over a year or so, the outcome and main recommendations of the Ministerial Task Team on Military Veterans was that the current act, that is the Military Veterans Affairs Act of 1999, needed to be overhauled, and the current act is basically restricted to simply enabling legislative protection of military veterans and their dependents, but without going into the detail of what are the range of benefits and services that military veterans should be entitled to and or their dependents. Now, the bill that is before you, Honorable Chair, is drafted in line with the recommendations of the Ministerial Task Team on Military Veterans, which recommendations served before Cabinet. They also served before the Portfolio Committee on Defense and Military Veterans. The long title of the bill, it's the Military Veterans Bill, and the bill provides for the principles recognized by the state as governing the affairs of military veterans and for policy objectives in this regard. Also for the president to be the patron-in-chief of all the military veterans. Furthermore, that benefits relating to, spelling out benefits relating to military veterans. Still further, the establishment of the Advisory Council on Military Veterans and the Military Veterans Appeal Board, those two institutions, and then spelling out certain functions of the Department of Military Veterans, and then lastly, providing for matters incidental thereto. The fundamental principles of the bill are set out in Section 3, which highlights the sacrifices made by military veterans and or their role in democratization of the country and ensuring that they are honored. Furthermore, that spell as a principle the compensation to which military veterans may be entitled to, that those or that form of compensation is not welfare. And then thirdly, spells out that there needs to be a means test utilized to determine the eligibility to the benefits. And then lastly, placing an obligation on organs of state and government departments to cooperate with the Department of Military Veterans and the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans to ensure the progressive realization of the benefits. Now, Section 4, Chairperson, Honorable Members, Section 4 of the bill spells out the role of the President insofar as military veterans is concerned, and that recognizing that the President is the Commander-in-Chief of the Defense Force, but insofar as military veterans are concerned, the President is the Patron-in-Chief of all the military veterans. This provision was drawn also from the previous Act of 1999, which actually also made that pronouncement of the President as the Patron-in-Chief of all military veterans. In terms of Section 5, which is the main heart of this bill, in addition to the fundamental principles, Section 5 of the bill spells out the benefits relating to military veterans, and these are listed as indicated there. The section lists 11, not 10. They were later amended to add the 11th one. The section lists 10 benefits which military veterans may be entitled to. Firstly, compensation to military veterans for occupational injuries, that is, military veterans who sustained disabling injuries or severe psychological and neuropsychiatric trauma, or who suffer from terminal diseases resulting from their participation in military activities. Two, Section 5.1b, counseling, that is dedicated counseling and treatment to military veterans who suffer from serious mental illness, post-traumatic stress disorder, or related conditions. With respect to the third benefit as highlighted, that is honoring and memorializing of fallen military veterans. And then fourth, access to and assistance with education, training and skills development for military veterans. And then fifth, facilitation of employment placement. And then sixth, the facilitation of or advice to military veterans on business opportunities. And then further, seven, subsidization or provisioning of public transport. And then eight, provisioning of pensions to military veterans. And then nine, access to health care then 10 housing and 11 burial support assistance. So in a nutshell, those are the benefits as spelled out in the bill, that's section 5.1 of the bill. Just to move further, we have left out the certain powers and duties of the department, but they are in the bill in section 6 and 7, which spell it out. And basically, those are powers generic to any department of state, but now here spelled out insofar as responsibilities for the advisory council or the appeal board or the umbrella association, the umbrella body of all military veterans. That is what Section 8 then spells out. And then Section 9 of the bill spells out what the functions of the National Umbrella Association of Military Veterans should do, what their functions should be. And briefly, those are to perform functions as provided in the Act, but also to advise the Minister on such matters relating to legislation and policy affecting military veterans, as the Minister may require. And then third and last, as a function of the National Military Veterans Association, advising the Minister or the Director General or on any other matter relating to the affairs of military veterans that the Minister or the Director General may require. Section 10, Chairperson, Honourable Member, Section 10 deals with the establishment of the Military Veterans Advisory Council, and it simply spells out that the Advisory Council, by passing the Act, is established to attend to the interests of military veterans, and then furthermore, its powers and duties are then spelled out in the bill, as well as its composition, as well as the processes and procedures for the appointment of members of the Advisory Council, and the nomination procedure for that. That is all in the subsequent section 11, 12, 13, as well as 14 and 15, which is the remuneration and allowances of the members and the term of office. And also resignations and removal of office. So those are all matters related directly to the Advisory Council. And then, Chairperson, on Section 19 deals with the establishment of the Military Veterans Appeal Board. And that appeal board is then established, and its powers, duties, and functions are also spelled out. And just to highlight, the minister appoints members of the board, the appeal board, and also designates the chairperson after consultation with the association. And then furthermore, that the function of the board will be to consider any appeal lodged with it by a military veteran against any decision taken by an official in terms of the Act, which may adversely affect the rights of the military veterans. And then further gives the power to the board to either confirm, set aside, or vary the relevant decision that has been made, or even substitute any other decision, or furthermore provide the required legal advice. So that is with respect to the appeal board. Now, Chair, if I may, just to highlight, and we can go into the details subject to your ruling, to highlight the gist of the matters that arose with respect to the bill as it was then before Parliament. Firstly, all of these matters that have been listed are matters that were strongly raised by way of written and oral submissions. Firstly, the issue of the definition of military veterans. There was lengthy debate on that matter, to which the department responded and engaged on. Secondly, the matter of the dishonorable discharge, that is a provision that is in the definition of military veteran, because dishonorable discharge simply spells out that even if you are a military, you were militarily trained in any of the armed forces, if you were dishonorably discharged, then you would not be recognized as a military veteran. So that became a hotly contested matter that was tabled in the public hearings. Furthermore, the president, as the patron in chief, that matter was also debated and subsequently led to the amendment of the section to only leave, restrict the role of the president insofar as military veterans is concerned to the president as the patron in chief. And then on the matter of the section 5.1 that we just went through, the issues that were flagged there very strongly on the benefits was on that 5.1e, which is the clause that reads facilitation of employment placement, and then F, facilitation of business opportunities for military veterans. That specific clause was also flagged in the public hearings and the submissions. And then furthermore, the hierarchy of needs, that clause relates to the provision in the fundamental principles in terms of the responsibility to determine the hierarchy of needs insofar as the delivery on all of the 11 benefits that have been indicated. And then the other, that is the mention of Samba. Samba, apologies, we didn't write it out in full. Samba is the South African National Military Veterans Association, which is the umbrella organization of all military veterans associations, 8 of them in total. It arose in the public hearings and led to a decision that the committee took that the mention of the organization by name in the legislation should be removed, but reference should be made to the principle. Hence, you see in the clause number nine, which in the bill, sorry, seven, in the bill, which is the National Military Veterans Association, without saying a SAMBA, and then spelling out what the responsibilities are of the association. And then lastly, the matter of the regulations. This was basically in the context of the need that a lot of the other details that is in the bill should be spelled out in the regulations. But furthermore, the committee then took a decision that the portfolio committee took a decision that once the regulations to the bill or the act at that point have been drafted, before they are promulgated, they should be brought back to the committee, so that the portfolio committee can satisfy itself that indeed they are in line with what is in the legislation. So, Chairperson, that is the gist of what we have to present before you. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Gunda and Honorable Matt, but before that, the definition of the military veterans, I can see, does not include, there are people who were part of the either First or Second World War. I know of a certain old man in Bethlehem who is 93 years old. He was part of one of those wars. He still has the medals and the photo and proof that he was part of that war. How are they covered in this law?
Yes, my question has been partly asked about the previous, the Second World War veterans who are still alive, some of them. And I would like to take it further. If the family can prove, if they are included, and the family can prove and bring the documents that their grandfather or great-grandfather, direct grandfather, were part of the, how will you then deal with them? And then other question, this battle between the apartheid regime and the struggle veterans, this South African colored corps, are they also included here? Those who were part of the apartheid regime, are they included here? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I guess
in addition would be the situation of the non-statutory forces as well as military veterans in there. But one chair would have hoped it's that we would have had the bill in time so that we engaged further. I think we're now at the tail end, and it's a bit disadvantaging. But one would have been interested in the dishonorable discharge. What it means, you have served, you might have served 20 years or 30 years, and you commit one offense that makes you get discharged, then you forfeit everything. That's what it is. So it's a punitive kind of situation. But I'm just mentioning by the way. The issues, Chair, with the I would like to know from the department if the I know they were, they used to be, I'm not sure now, I'm not sure if they are part of the submissions, and also the presenter was mentioned eight association. There used to be an association of disabled veterans, so to speak. To say that did they present here, because there's two, if you look at clause 5, the list of the benefits, for instance, part of the issues is the issues of rehabilitation in the care, and the care of disabled veterans, generally issues of assistive devices. I'm not sure whether it's in the list here, in the benefit list, because these devices can be so expensive, Mr. Ness is sitting on this wheelchair, it's over 30,000 rand. His wheelchair is over 30,000 rand. A cushion alone, 20,000 rand. So the devices, they're quite expensive. Then secondly, the placement issue, placed there, I think it's E, where does it, there used to be the sheltered workshops. Is it envisaging that is it securing that area? Because I know government is spending, I think they are now run by the Labour Department, if I'm not mistaken, and between the Labour Department and Social Development, they used to, it's almost 40 million rand that is spent on these sheltered employment workshops that are produced, factories, I don't know what the current name now, title for them. And also, in some quarters, they use, and these benefits, are they, is there anywhere in the bill, are they means tested in terms of accessing the benefits? And, if that matter has been concluded, if these benefits will be means tested. Thank you, Chair.
It's also the definition. I think 2 months ago, there was a group called themselves the Khoisan Military Group. Now, are they also included here or not? Thanks, Chair.
Okay, you can respond.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, members. On the first question of the Second World War, yes, the definition does include those military veterans who saw action during the First and the Second World War. That provision was there in the 1999 Military Veterans Affairs Act. In this Military Veterans Act 2011, it's still included. However, the order has changed, and if members can look at the Section 1 of the definitions, in particular C, from the very last, it says military veteran means, and let me, through you, Chairperson, just highlight, military veteran means any South African citizen who, one, rendered military service to any of the military organizations, statutory and non-statutory, which were involved on all sides of South Africa's liberation war from 1960 to 1994, and then secondly, served in the Union Defense Force before 1961, or thirdly, became a member of the new South African National Defense Force, SANDF, after 1994, and then expand further, and has completed his or her military training, and no longer performs military service, performs military service, and has not been dishonorably discharged from that military organization or force, provided that this definition does not exclude any person referred to in paragraph A, B, or C, who could not complete his or her military training due to an injury sustained during military training or a disease contracted or associated with military training. So that is the definition as we have it of the military veteran, and it also answers then the Honourable Member's question about whether this includes those who fought in the apartheid era armed forces and or whatever corps, Cape Coloured Corps or the Native Corps and so on. They are all included. We should say that actually this definition was reached after very lengthy debate, even before the matter was tabled to Parliament. And in Parliament itself, there was equally long debate, which then got to what we now have here, raising some of the concerns that the Honourable Members have.
On the very same issue, when the benefits are due, how are you going to ensure that you reach out to all of them, even those who are deceased? Maybe the family members are still alive, but they have documents to prove that the deceased were part of qualify for those benefits. How are you going to reach out to them?
Okay, if I may answer that immediately. We have one critical tool, and it is in the bill, the database. We have a database of military veterans, which we are continuously updating, and it includes those who are in this total definition, First World War, Second World War, post-Union Defense Force, and so on, as well as the more recent ones are also included within that. In terms of reaching out, the database has the information about the individual members, but as I've indicated, we are on a program now to continuously update the information of the members. We will have a communication to all the provinces and the regions as we go out, so that we are able to have a credible database. Because even if we have a database, some of the information may well have changed over time, changed in terms of the status of the member. Maybe the member had registered that they have two dependents, they now have three dependents, or that they were three, they are now two, or that at the time of registration they were unemployed, they are now employed, whichever the case may be. And even outside of the database, daily we continue to receive representations from military veterans who are not registered. We enter into a process to verify them with their organizations or also directly with them as well, and seeking that they fulfill certain requirements, after which we then treat them as such and begin to extend the benefits to the members. Okay. If I may go on. Chair, the question of the dishonorably discharged. Note is taken of what the Honourable Member has said. The way that it is proposed that the matter is, it will be dealt with, will be through the appeal board that is set out in the bill. The appeal board will have the power to receive representation from military veterans who are grieved in one way or another. One of those may be that they are not now being recognized due to them having been dishonorably discharged, even if they may have had a long years of service, and then due to one or other misdemeanor, they are then dishonorably discharged. Representations that we have had so far have alluded to the fact that, and we know as a matter of history and record, that there are indeed those military veterans, especially from the former non-statutory forces, who were dishonorably discharged at the beginning of the integration process. And hence we then have this mechanism of an appeal board, so that then once all the facts are placed before the appeal board, then the decision can be varied.
Now that's it. Yeah. Okay. Right there. I've seen here in this document there's a letter here. There's a submission in this document.
Yes.
And I've been thinking about this, but when I'm reading this, what's your name? When I'm reading this letter, I'm realizing no matter what I've been thinking about. This guy or this military veteran has been dishonorably discharged. Exactly, we're pointing to a very critical point, because at that time of integration, this is where most of the things happened. And even after, when these FATF guys were on top and the British, and most of these non-statutory guys were chased out of the army. Now, you are said they were dishonorably discharged. Some of them have passed away, and they've got dependents. Who's going to make representation for them? It goes without talking about representation. I mean, yes, because you are talking about the board. It goes with this letter that I've seen here. Who's going to make representation for these people? Because they've got dependents, and these people were military veterans, but they've passed away. Just if I can be clarified today, I'll be happy. And then the other thing that I want to understand is Department of Military Veterans. What is that? What is the Department of Military Veterans? Who is the minister of that department? Because I'm not sure. Is it not the Department of Defense? Or what? If I can be clarified, I'll be very happy.
You can respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I start with the last one first? The Department of Military Veterans is a department that was proclaimed in law as a department with its own accounting officer and head of department, but the political accountability for the Department of Military Veterans resides in the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans. Yeah. Hence the long title of the ministry. But when you then go department, it's now two departments. There's the Department of Defense on the one hand and then the other one. On the matter of dishonorably discharged, if the members are so deceased, who would deal with their matters? If we have representations by a family member or somebody, even if not necessarily a member of the family of the deceased, then we would take up such and then process it further, so that the dependents can then be also recipients of whatever of the benefits that are listed in that section 5.
That issue that I think, say for example, I am independent of the deceased, and I'm not aware that he was dishonorably discharged. How is it going to be proven that I don't qualify for those benefits?
Just on that, is that not the way, taking into consideration the situation in the country? No? In the country, because there's a lot of disadvantage, particularly to non-statutory, yeah, particularly the black community, you know, because it is difficult. Is that not the way of excluding, continuing with the
same way the apartheid state worked in making sure that they exclude, you know, because people might know, they might not be able to can present their cases, you know, taking that into consideration, but also taking the points that were raised earlier, you know, around the level of education, the level of, you know, all those things, and the way people were treated when the forces came back, you know, and when they were supposed to be integrated, precisely because of, you know, trying to remain in charge and make sure that you control that section of the government, you know. And is that not a form of exclusion that we are now entrenching that? Because in the main, it will be those statutory forces that will come back who will be able, you know, to can present to this specific body. I mean, when you looked at this particular matter, did you not take that into consideration? Because there is a serious problem. I know of a number of people. I mean, I'm from Mamelodi, you know? And in a way, that's where part of the base of this non-statutory bodies were. You know? And it is very clear up to now, if you take the process around the benefits that they were getting now, a lot of them were excluded precisely because some could not properly present, you know, their cases there. And it's a problem, you know. And I'm saying, is this not another form of assisting that process of excluding? And you will always have a number of people that are disgruntled precisely because we are too technical, and I agree we should be, you know, but we'll be looking at those, after those, that can present them to themselves properly. And I'm saying, if you look at the children, the point that has been raised here, you know, most of those beneficiaries might not understand, neither know, what is the department doing in making sure that they assist those particular, because you see, issues are too technical, you know. This appeal board, you know, you'll find advocates sitting there, you know, people who will not be at the level of that particular constituency. And what is it that you assist, how do you assist them to deal with those particular matters? Because to me, it seems it's a clear exclusion. Because you will be excluding people, I'm not saying it's purposeful, you know, but you see, we are assisting that particular process. What we said we fought against, you know, we are bringing back indirectly in the name of professionalism.
where lies the onus? Who must prove that he is entitled? Is it the department with its massive resources, taking into account that the people who are referring to will not have those resources? Who must prove? Honorable Nzimande, Honorable Nessie.
Just a follow-up there, Chair. Whether this dishonorably
discharged. Is the offences, are they listed somewhere? Is there an exhaustive list? Or, you know, how is it captured and defined? I think on its own.
Chapter 9 is similar. I think it's similar, if it's not the same thing with the Monday. I'm a family member. I'm the mother of this child. My husband has passed away. He was a military veteran. Now he has been dishonorably discharged. Now I'm going there. What is it that I'm going to present? Because there's a lawyer that side, and then the person maybe from the army, advocates from the board and everybody. As a woman with these children of that man, I was not there in the army, and the man, when he came back from the army with his monies, whatever, later didn't explain to me, what is it that I'm going to present there in the board? Because the dependents will still be there with me, and I'll still be frustrated. And the issue here is that the poor people, the working class, when we talk in terms of the class here, the working class are the ones which are going to suffer. They are going to bear the consequences. In fact, the freedom fighters. They are the ones which are going to be disadvantaged by the war situation. I'm just interested to know if you can explain to me what are these people going to present, because they don't know what happened when this man was chased away from the army or this woman. Thank you, sir.
Chair, you know, it's a very difficult one, this one, the verification part of this of a military veteran. Let me make an example. You see, with the DMOB, many people came in who were not MK or APLA or whatever. They came in to claim. I know I was part and parcel of that thing. Now, with this one, it's going to be similar, I can tell you now, because the unemployment problem of the country is very, very serious. Now, many people will come and claim now. You see, all these questions goes with verification. What method are you going to use to verify that Dennis Bloom is a veteran? Thanks.
I'm having a medal.
Go and start his squad.
You can respond.
Now, just on the method of verification, at the moment, and we continue to refine, but the main method of verification that we use is the certified personnel register that was submitted by all the integrating forces in April 1994, 26th of April 1994. By midnight of that time, all the forces were expected to have submitted the name list, certified name list of their members. Of course, and after which time, then the SANDF kicked in as an integrated force. Of course, even subsequent to that, there were lists that were received right until 1998, when a piece of legislation was passed now to close the door on integration, that is the Termination of Integration Act, to actually now say we now satisfactorily, because it was open-ended, to say can submit up to within a reasonable time. But at that point, at the peak of the size of the defense force. But that aside, we use that as a base for that, but also the records that are in the archives in the case of those who were in the Second World War, First World War, and also in the Korean War. And then those who, if a person demobbed, there is a record of that. And we use that as well as a part of a verification method. Sometimes, in fact, practically, we have military veterans who demobbed, but they may not be knowing their force number. But when we enter their details into the system, we immediately pick up that no. Member so-and-so, they did receive a demob of that amount, and indeed, this is the force that they belong to. We do have cases, there are not that many, of members who didn't demob or integrate. Military veterans who neither demob nor integrated. And therefore, they would not be captured on a system, so to speak. How that is dealt with? It is dealt with in consultation with their military formations. And this applies especially to members of MK as well as members of APLA. And then, of course, now coming the issue of AZANLA, which is not yet recognized, but I'll stick to only those two. There is a process to consult with their organizations, including their organizations providing a service certificate for such a member, that this was so-and-so, they served from this time to that time. And on that basis, we then capture and record further that they are indeed a bona fide members. And all of that is a part of the whole process that we are already undertaking to clean up our database, update it, also improve the record on it. And so that once or when we begin to accelerate delivery of the benefits, we are doing so against the basis of bona fide military veterans and or their dependents. The question that the Honourable Member has asked in terms of...
Just a moment.
I just want to be clear. You see, there are those that on their way to... who were keeping the country then, on their way out. Yeah? And there are a number of them were killed. Yeah? At no stage... Because there might not be records of, but it's known that there are these groups that were killed on their way out. You know what Mama Sela did?
Yes.
That is the first area that I wanted to check. There are those that just before 1994, who neither went out but operated in the country, underground structures, who were given life sentences, 24 years, 35 years, whatever. What? I'm just saying, because they're excluded from that whole process. They're excluded at this particular point in time. How do you deal with that particular situation? You see? Because these people were either sentenced, and I'll give a clear example. You know, we're fighting a case where we said these people did nothing. You know, but they stayed for 19 years in prison. They stayed for 19 years. They were just released early this year. We fought for them. These people are not recorded anywhere else. There's nothing that is happening. How do you accommodate that type of people? You see? Because in terms of the definition itself, you don't have that situation. But I'm just saying, some people died. I mean, we know about thousands of them who were killed on the way out, precisely because they were tracked down by the security forces of this country, the old security forces, you see? And killed. We know a number of them whom we are still repairing now, because, repairing, and those are the situations. How do we deal with that situation? I'm just saying, because they are not part of what you have indicated to us.
Just to answer on this particular one, we do have a mechanism to deal with that, and in fact, we are already dealing with that category. Firstly, they would be having a force that they belonged to, even if they got intercepted as they were leaving the country. Or even if they never left, they were internal operatives, they would be under a specific command. And so all of those mechanisms of verification we follow, including also those who up to now are still classified as missing persons in accordance with the TRC. Records and so on, which has just over 500 missing persons on their records. They've so far been able to find 55 who've been positively identified, exhumed, and reburied. Just the last 3 weeks, we were reburying some of them. On Saturday, there was a reburial that we officiated at in Mamelodi. The week before, there were three from Soweto who had been exhumed and then found, exhumed and reburied, and so on it goes. So we do recognize on the basis of that. That is those who may not necessarily have been part of the certified personnel register.
Lastly, I'm happy they have done it in the chance, because the reason why we're asking like this is because we're dealing with the communities.
Yes,
now, these people in the constituencies, for instance, I'm asking the question is not generally. I'm asking with specific reference, because I know there are people there that these things have happened. Their wives are there, their children are there, they are suffering. Now, and there's this thing which has been raised here of unemployment and corruption in this country, that many, many people are going to use this, attempting to put their names and everything, but you are saying here are the mechanisms of verifying. I'm happy about that. And then also I want to ask others, for instance, is it not easy for others who were in the armies? For instance, I'm from Grahamstown. Other guys were there in the army, maybe PE or whatever. Is it not easy for them to go to where the armies, where the offices they were working, to register them, maybe the wives, or if it's a man, to go and register? In fact, the point is, where are they going to register these people so that they can be known? I've seen the guy from the army, the general, talking on the television, saying, for instance, the non-statutory, most of them, there are very few, and that's in the military, veterans, whatever, the database from this side. The reasons are clear, these ones that we are raising. But then, what do we do in this case as members of parliament? What role can we play in our constituency? Because the desperate situation, people don't know about this. They won't know about this till at the end. If you go to the thing of special pensions, for instance, many, many people didn't register. They didn't know. They heard about it. They didn't know. But their children are there. They are suffering. Later, they are told that even if your father have participated, you should have registered. And it could have been verified by your organization. But it's late because everything is closed. The same thing is going to happen here. But if we can be clarified now, what role can we play so that we can inform the communities properly, not generally the communities, in fact, because if I were to inform, I will inform the families that I know, because my location is small. I know the people there, and then also your responsibility to talk to the country so that people can know what is it that we can do, where can they go and register for this, so that they can be verified, and then we make sure that at least those who they have suffered and then their children can benefit. I understand. I think the point of people who were on their way out is equal to those who were on their way back. Because I know of many who were on their way back and who have died, and then their bones have been buried, but their families, I'm not families as such, their children have not benefited. So if you can just say to me, this is how members of parliament can assist in their communities so that these families or these children can know where to go and register, maybe get the verifications. If the appeal board, they are, in fact, they are rejected there, where else can they go? And what is it that is best can we do? The reason why I'm asking this question, I know many, many people who are supposed to benefit in these things, they don't. And who benefits is those who are not supposed to be benefiting, who will be robbing the system. Because the ones which are robbing the systems, they do have the techniques, they understand everything that is supposed to be done. The ones who are supposed to benefit, they don't know. And at times we don't know what role can they play. If maybe you say to me, this is what you can do to assist, this is where these people can go, and as members, this is what you can do in your constituencies. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair, honorable members. In the structure, well, in the uniform department, but we work closely with our sister Department of Defense, and we are also, to a degree, using the infrastructure and capability that they have. The structure and the plans that we have for the Department of Military Veterans is a presence in all the provinces as an initial phase. The second phase, a presence in the regions. So from province then in the regions within the provinces. So that is what we have planned. At the moment, as we receive, and we do receive some of the queries such as the one specific one that you're raising, we do deal with it with the particular families. I know sometimes the challenge becomes how do you get from a certain point to where that service will be delivered, but we do deal with them For instance, we have issued service certificates, or not service, medals for those who were in the Second World War, who are still alive, some deceased, but their family members may come in contact with us, and we do that, and issue, go into the record and the archives, pull that out, and then issue that to the families. So in terms of how yourselves as members of parliament can assist, is to, at the moment, direct that to us as the Department of Military Veterans directly, with the whatever detail and contact or communication that we can be able to deal with, and then we will then take it from there. Even if we don't yet have offices in the provinces, we will go out there to do that. Just by way of example, about three to 4 weeks ago, we went out to deal with a specific case. You may have seen it in the media, of a military veteran, Mr. Mudingi, who had not had all of his special pension, and then issues around his health care and so on. We went out to deal with that case, and at the moment it's receiving attention. We went as the Department of Military Veterans in terms of our mandate, but also coordinating with the Special Pensions Office to see what issues or what the problem was in terms of that particular office not having given him all his pension entitlements. So we do have that, and we hope that we will communicate even more with our constituents. We, as a way of protocol, we are dealing also with the military veterans associations themselves, their structures, leadership, and so on. But the attitude we take is that at the end of the day, with or without the organizations, it is the individual military veteran and their dependents that we must deal with. Because organizations being what they are, there are always issues and so on, and we have chosen that we will have that multi-pronged approach in approaching this. Ms. Ranta would like to make some addition on the earlier point.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks, DG. And just to add on what the DG has said, Chairperson, I think we would like to say to the honourable members here that the process to develop the bill and go through it up until where we are at was very mindful of the very many issues that have been raised this afternoon. And it is precisely because we as a department have a responsibility, therefore, stemming from what came out from the processes and the intention that has been driving this whole process. We are very mindful as the department, therefore, that we have to do the best we can to make certain that the people who need these benefits the most access these benefits. And within that context, therefore, the issue of verification indeed is very important. And DG has already indicated that there are a whole lot of systems that enable us to verify bona fide military veterans. But also it is important to indicate that one other way of making certain that whoever we are going to be benefiting in this particular program for benefits to military veterans who is not already on the military veterans, national military veterans database, the verification process that is in place at this point in time also has within its context a panel of people who sit to interview those who say are military veterans. And that panel is composed of people from different organizations of military veterans. Like, for instance, you have APLA sitting there, AZANLA sitting there, and all those. And they have very pertinent questions they ask that only a military veteran can respond to. So we believe to a very large extent that we are making certain that whoever comes out as a military veteran, for those who are yet to be verified, is indeed a bona fide military veteran. And around World War veterans, the department is already undertaking research, because we know that in the past after the World War and when benefits were given to soldiers when they came back, the same benefits, black and white soldiers did not access the same benefits the same way. And the department is undertaking research to determine exactly what went on in that particular context, because based on that, we then are looking to say as a department, how do we then make it right for widows of military veterans of the World War, World Wars, who are at this point in time very destitute. And we visited a number of them. We know how desperate, how destitute they are, but we are saying something has to be done to set the, you know, to correct that situation, and that research is going to enable us to do that. With regard to dishonorable a military veteran dishonorably discharged and dependents and their dependents and access to benefits, I think, as DG indicated, the appeals board is the one instrument that we will be using a lot, because when a dependent comes to say to the department to request for support in terms of benefits that they ought to be receiving, the database will enable us to know whether or not the principal military veteran was dishonorably discharged or not. And where we find that somebody was dishonorably discharged, indeed we will assist the family or the dependents to use the appeals board process to then make certain that we correct what is wrong, what was wrong in that particular context. The issue of means test, yes, indeed, we are currently finalizing the means test with our legal department, which means tests, again, as part of the regulations, must come before the Parliament Portfolio Committee for noting and for also inputs if it should be improved in any way. There's another issue, just to illustrate the issues that the department are dealing with. There's an issue of our military veterans and their widows who are not South Africans, who come from other countries on the continent. Up until now, we have been doing very little as a country to assist those widows. But as a department, we have already started engaging with them, because their case is rather special in the sense that they do not have support systems that they ought to have. And we know as a department that we can't leave them out. We have to do the best we can to also support them and support their children. So I'm saying all this, Chairperson and honorable members, to say we believe that as a department, we understand our mandate, the challenges that come with it, the responsibility that comes with it, because it says we must work hard and go an extra mile to make certain that the people who really must access these services do access the services. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much.
I haven't finished my question, sir.
Okay.
I haven't finished all my concerns already. One was around disability and the associations consulted, the placement, the short-term employment, that kind.
Thanks, Chairperson, honorable members. On the associations of disabled military veterans, we did not have any formal or even official representation from the associations of disabled military veterans. And I think the honorable member is referring also to there's an organization called QRAMAS, which was established by the Defense Force, particularly with a focus to look at the disabled military veterans. We have not had the full engagement with them yet, but that is something that we will be aiming to do with respect to do that. In terms of the actual assistance, then, we are working with the military health services, insofar as those military veterans who may have incurred a disability, just in accordance with the way the bill is spelling it out, because Healthcare is one benefit that we have already started to roll out to military veterans since December 2010, once the minister had authorized that. Because in looking at all of the benefits, it was felt that that is one which should be an absolute top priority, the issue of healthcare. And we continue to extend that to the members. On the placement issue, we have not begun to utilize that. In general terms, we are already engaging with different line function departments with respect to each of the benefits that have been listed to enter into service level agreements as well as memoranda of understanding with them, which would spell out the detail of what assistance those particular departments would do with respect to delivery to military veterans. So, for instance, if we say housing, we're engaging already with the Department of Human Settlement. If we're saying transport, we're already engaging with the National Department of Transport. Issues of welfare and so on, we're engaging with social development in terms of what interventions can and are being made in so far as that is concerned. And then healthcare, as I've said, is already being rolled out by the military health services in all the provinces to military veterans. All we do, we say we are the first point of contact for military veterans, and then we would then take that further if it is not in our competence to deliver that service. In the planning and the budget, we have also allocated for that. Hence, you will see at the end of the bill in terms of what the financial implications of the bill are in the medium-term expenditure framework. Once the bill is passed into an act, Treasury said that they will then begin to actually allocate those resources in that regard. Now, if I may go back, Ms. Lanta mentioned the issue of the Second World War. In fact, the more one looks at the dispensation that was rolled out for Second World War, retaining soldiers Second World War, what government did at the time, the more one is actually convinced about the need for this particular dispensation. In fact, it does not go far enough, what we have in the bill now. If one looks at even the reports of what they called the demobilization directorate that was established in 1944, it spells out all of these issues into detail in terms of what the responsibilities of government are. Of course, we know, because apartheid was in full swing at the time, there were those differences in terms of what they call the natives will receive and what whites received at the time. But be that as it may, that is a very detailed, elaborate plans and systems that were put in place, whether talking education, jobs, retraining, burial support, housing, land for military veterans, all of that. Those were in there. I don't know, Chair, if I've been able to so far respond to all the issues.
Chairperson, clarity again on the definition. A person who have, you see, 1990 after the unbanning of political parties, there were 3 months crash courses in Transkei. No, that was not SDUs. It was military training there. I'm interested to know if those people are also been going to be classified as military veterans. Thanks, Chair.
One military.
You are from the training, I know.
Just one clarity. As we work with communities, and I'm saying we are coming across, and I know these people have not been part of the army, have not been part of anything else, but we are coming across this type of people, and I'm not sure as to how do we deal with that. Is it? because possibly they would have gone there. I mean, we came across about close to 6-7 grannies. These people were put under either house arrest until 1990, from the 60s. And I'm not sure as to how do we classify this type of people. How do you deal with them? Because I'm not sure the reality of the matter is they have not gone to the army. Possibly if they were not arrested or put under house arrest or whatever, possibly they would have gone. We are not sure. Possibly they have done something else. And I'm clear with it. Mm-hmm. But the problem is how do we deal with this type of people? You know, mm-hmm. I'ean, I'm just saying just 6 months ago, we discovered one in Istres. One who Spanish man, she was put under house arrest, right? Until when the announcements was made around the unbanning of political parties. Right? When that was made, the police forces then went to her house and then indicated that, look, you can do as you wish now, you are free. You see? I'm just saying, you have all these people. I don't want to say she's part of the military, she's part of us. How do we deal with that type of a situation? You see? Because some of them feel they were part of that particular struggle, they were part of the fight, they were part of... And they've not read any precisely because possibly when Mkhonto Sisu was established or whatever, a few years down the line, then they're arrested. What then happens? You see? Those are the issues. And I'm just saying, how do we deal? Because there's nowhere that they are catered for. There's no way that this type of people are catered for. Because at some point it might look like people who are, you know, I'm just saying this is the situation. And I know possibly you have not come across that type of a situation. Therefore, you know, you haven't thought about it. You see?
Let me illustrate further to what my colleague is saying here. Med Dordi Nyembe, I will call it a name. Med Dordi Nyembe, for instance, spent a long time in Kroonstad prison. Now, she came to parliament and then she passed away. Now, to further strengthen this question, what is going to happen to her family? I'm sure Med Dordi was having children and if she don't, but relatives and so on. What is going to happen to that? And I know she was doing underground work for the organization.
Which one?
Before you respond, the interval numbers we have to prove to her partner. Do you still have any? Because you are aware that this has been a very emotional matter, and that we hope that you understand why we give the way we do. You can just step up.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members. No, thank you for the engagement. We certainly welcome it, and the questions and issues you raised are indeed issues that we are filled with literally on a daily basis, on any of the category of the questions that the honorable members are asking. To respond to this immediate last one, yes, we let me put it this way. One, it's not in our mandate to deal with those members who are not military veterans. But that said, we recognize and we have already had approaches with respect to cases such as the ones the honorable members have talked about. What should have happened, in fact, is that, and it is there in the law, the Special Pensions Act was precisely for exactly those kinds of situations. Of your Mato Rotinyembe and many others in that category. The lady in Fort Flores yesterday who was banned for many years and so on. It is there. And that is actually one of the areas where we are continuously interfacing with the Special Pensions Office, because we interface also in the context of people coming to us saying, no, but my application has been rejected by the Special Pensions Office. I don't understand why. And there, unfortunately, then we look at what the provisions of the Special Pensions Act are. And sometimes we do find that indeed the rejection of some of those applications was not correct and in the interpretation of that particular office.
Yes, to interrupt, one of the limitations to the Special Pensions Act, it limits the age of the people who qualify to 35.
Yeah.
And you know how brutal of a process it is to fully younger and those issues were retained. Yes, but the limitation is that to limit the age to people who are 35.
Yes, no, certainly. They subsequently amended it to 30. But we have that challenge. And in many ways also, what the Special Pensions has, there is some overlapping of the database that the Special Pensions has, because within those who are beneficiaries of Special Pensions, you also find military veterans within the Special Pensions legislation. But we do deal with it. It's a matter that also arose during the public hearings. The Kulumane Support Group raised this matter, but in the context of saying that, why should beneficiaries as listed, or the benefits as listed in the military veterans bill, why should that not extend, or is not extending to all of the military, no, so all the struggle veterans, even those that were not in the military. Of course, in response, we did indicate, also taking from our legal advice, that for struggle veterans, so to speak, the Special Pensions Act would then cover that, with all its imperfections, would be able to cover that. On the members who, or those who received crash courses of 3 months or maybe even less, whether they are also military veterans, including your self-defense units in certain instances, the answer is yes. They would be classified as military veterans if they can point to membership of an armed force and can be verified as bona fide by their organization. Who trained you? Where did you train? What was the duration? All of those kind of questions and so on. They would be. In fact, some of them found their way into the Defense Force through the Certified Personnel Register that was submitted by all the different forces. But we know that there are some, again, not many, who did not find their names onto the list, but we do enter into that process of verification. We are mindful of the challenge, of course, of fraudulent enlistment. And similarly, as the honorable members have pointed to that being a problem with the Special Pensions, or having been a problem with DMOB in certain instances, even with integration, we are very mindful of that being one of the challenges that we are going to face as the Department of Military Veterans. Because now and again, Johnny or Mary pops up and they lay claim to being a military veteran. And we then have to engage with them on that. But, Chair, I don't know if we finished all the questions, but that is all we have to say so far in terms of what is in the bill. We are open to engage with yourselves. Should the committee be of the opinion that we need to appear once more, we will certainly do that. We are at your disposal. Thank you,
Chair. Chair, the last point, I want to disagree with that issue of crash courses and what is three committees? What? SDUs. You see, I'm on the ground. Many say, I know of people who are Matingalans, who's all of a sudden now MK veteran. I
was in charge of one unit. I don't know those people in my area, but now they are all of a sudden veterans. We must look into those things. We must look into those things, because this thing will cost billions of rand, and it's taxpayers' money. We can't. I mean, I know that unemployment and poverty and hunger is a very serious problem in the country, but we can't also promote corruption further. We must sieve this thing through.
I would agree with Honorable Bloom that it would be better sometimes maybe to use even members of parliament, the department, in order to verify. Because if we are caught, then this, it will be difficult for us. Because if you talk of the SP special pensions, I was in a queue with people in Port Elizabeth from my own country. And then when I looked, they want this one, what? And they were busy, come, now what is the story? And when I checked later, people who are in the organization, they signed for those people.
Yes.
That is the problem. Now it becomes, I think, better when you come, and I can't stand up and say, hey, well, you don't belong here. I have to be quiet and then go. But if you come back and verify, it will be very difficult for me to lie. Because if it has been proved somewhere by the department that the member of parliament has lied on this, I think it becomes difficult. It will help you if you do that in terms of verification. I was worried about the SDUs because Honorable Bloom might find the way. But I would also request the person if we can have the contact numbers so that at the moment, the ones that we know relevantly that they belong here, we can at least refer them to you so that they can start early, because everybody is going to, they are going to swell the ranks of this department in an attempt to get money. I can hear, I mean, it's very wide and open. Everybody is coming to request for this money, but I would advise you, if you take members of parliament and use them for verification, because they are, I mean, are they are what's this? Oath, what's that? Commissioners of oath.
Yeah.
In the event that after you verified with the member and you don't stop there, you continue and you find that member doing, you know, fraudulent things, then it's better, because somehow you received elsewhere and then they make an example, because it's very, very difficult. Corruption in South Africa is worse than anything else. That is why the military veterans are going to suffer. Because it's going to take too long because of these verifications, because you've got so many numbers. Like the special pensions. Special pensions, people can't get those monies. They are crying. Others are suffering, really. I'm waiting for mine too. But I'm not suffering in any way. But there are communities, people, children that are sleeping without anything to eat. And I know that the reason why is because there are so many people there who must be verified who are not supposed to be there. Thank you very much.
I wanted to say let's adopt. But Commissioner Bloom was just saying something to me here.
Yeah.
But when I looked at what was presented to us, Chair, I want to move for the adoption.
Yeah.
Chairperson, you know, I was busy with this before. I don't have a problem in adopting this, but this verification and definition, can't we work out? You see, we have raised a lot of things here. And it's not included into this whole thing. There's a lot of loopholes in the verification and the definition. I don't know, Chair. If we say we adopt it, I don't have a problem. But these things that we have raised, we must not come back next month and say we have not, we are not clear about it. I'm just saying that let us think of this thing. We adopt it now, it's fine. But after a year, when people are crying, our constituents is crying, we can't come back and say that no, we have not think about it properly.
I think they have listened to us and they have noted issues that we have raised, issues that are of concern. And I hope that they will deal with them to our satisfaction.
You hope so?
I hope so.
I wanted us to move for the adoption. The issues we have raised, let them deal with them in terms of the regulations. The regulations, so that then, therefore, it becomes important that the regulations must come to us.
So that you hope so.
I second the adoption.
Okay, in that case, honorable members, the committee, having considered the military veterans bill, referred to it, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. But please don't put the
yes, that's why you should be there as part of the verification, and we agree with the honorable members. We agree.
So we put
and,
it
and
in
said,
there.
No, not in the administration, but in the case like this, you say, in your area.
Thank you.